Welcome to Music on the Rocks with me, Chris Castellanos, and I am introducing the great Marty Hackelman right now. He has been one of my horn heroes for a long, long time. Not only is he a great orchestral player and a great soloist, but he did for many years what it is that I enjoy doing the most, which is make chamber music with world-class brass players. And he was the one who paved the road for all of us who are doing it right now. So it's a real pleasure to have you, Marty.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
Cheers. All right. So what do you have there, man?
Oh, just some wine.
Nice. I'm drinking a nice Woodford Reserve here.
Oh, that'd be nice. Well, we'll get into that later on, but I didn't want to get too, you know.
Yeah.
We had a Manhattan before dinner, and I thought I better slow down, you know. Oh.
Yeah, man. I've been missing flying. I'm actually missing the road a lot, and I'm missing flying. And my favorite airplane drink was Woodford that they would serve on the Delta flights there.
Yeah. Yeah, flying's a lot different now, boy.
Oh. I haven't done it since March 12th. The concert was canceled in Chicago, we were supposed to do. And I flew there, had dinner with the guys, and flew right back the next day. That was the last airplane I've gotten on. So it's been the longest period of time for me not being on a plane in about 17 or 18 years.
Wow.
Crazy.
Yeah, you do get used to it. I mean, I remember in the day, and it was very different back then. It was so much easier. You know, we did a Russian tour before the wall came down. And I remember, for instance, now this really happened, okay? We get on this Aeroflot flight, and it was one of those old DC-7 prop planes that are tilted like this, you know?
Right.
So you go up the gangplank, and this is like 1950s airplane. Now, firstly, we get on, and one of our people that are a shepherdess around, there were always two people. One was Nikita, this big 6'4" Russian guy, and the other was a woman. And she knew English because of, I don't know why, but she was very friendly and nice person and really helped us a lot, but she really wanted to marry one of us because that's the only way she could get out of Russia. And she was an ex-hooker. So it was awkward all the time. Well, this particular flight, she decided, I don't know where she got it or why she had this. She was going to carry on a houseplant onto the flight. Now, you would think that perhaps that's a little odd. This houseplant was a 5-foot tree. She carried this bloody houseplant in the pot on the plane, put it between her legs. Nobody said a word. 5-foot tree. But this is the same flight where refreshments come down. You use the cart, right, et cetera, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. A woman came down the aisle with a very large bottle of Pellegrino and a glass.
Uh-huh.
Came to every person, would you like some water? Everybody shared the same glass.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, one glass, one bottle. Would you like a plate, take a pour? I said, no, thank you. I think I'll pass. But anyway, yeah. So just a flight that, yeah.
What group were you with at the time?
That was Empire. That was Empire.
Okay.
Yeah. We did a Russian tour that was surreal. I mean, there were so many things that happened on that tour on an hourly basis. Like, what? You know, like.
Well, that's one of the best parts about those touring jobs is just the days are never really the same.
No. Know?
You get up, you're in a different place, you're playing for different people with different presenters, and there's rarely a dull time, you know?
I mean, it's you know, traveling around can be, like you say, stultifyingly boring, or if you got a day off and you're sitting in the hotel room, it's like, oh, God, just shoot me now. but then at the time, I found over the years, as I did it, I really loved doing it and stuff, but sometimes it got to the place where I would wake up in the morning, and I wouldn't know where I was, and I would think, like, where am I? And then I said to myself, you know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Get up and go find something to eat. And, you know, so,
yeah,
you know what it's like. It's exciting in many ways. Like you say, you're meeting different people, different situations. But after a while, man, sometimes it gets a little, like, numbing.
Yeah. You know? I can totally appreciate that, man. When I first started touring, I was always, like, all gung-ho about finding like the local place to eat and checking out the town and walking around. Yeah. Now it's just kind of like, you know,
the thing is people said, oh, you traveled all over the world. I said, no, I saw a lot of hotels and concert halls. I didn't tour. I didn't go to beaches and museums very much. You know what I mean? You don't have the time or the energy.
Right.
You go crash, you practice, you get up, you know, you play a concert, you have a drink, you go do it again.
Yep. The thing that makes it great though, I mean, and not boring, is having other people with you on the road. And that's what I love about the kind of touring that we have done, is that it's not like when you're a soloist and you go out by yourself.
That would be really boring.
I couldn't do it. I mean, I've done it for a little bit, and it's just, man, just even the part of getting off the plane and not seeing your buddies at the rental car place or anything like that. And you're just like, well, somebody's going to pick me up. Or
Yeah. No, the times when I've gone and done solo things for days on a week or so, it's like, man, you really feel lonely. Mm-hmm. And you're around people and stuff, but it's not the same. You know?
Not the same at all, yeah.
But, yeah, the road is a different animal. But, you know, I think it's going to come. I mean, everybody nowadays is really worried, as we should be. It's definitely not going to be the change. Same. We know that. Right. And everybody's saying, but nobody's going to care about it. Everybody's giving it away. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think that as the smoke clears, a number of things are going to happen that's going to end up in a better place. Even symphony orchestras, but even the chamber groups, the touring groups, whatever. I've read a few articles that a lot more people, because of this confinement, are exploring and appreciating classical music. They're mm-hmm. seeing it more than they ever have. And they're like, that's pretty cool. There's something more than indie rock pop, you know, whatever. And it's not that it's supplanting it, but it's adding more things. So I think we're actually adding listeners, and that who, once the walls come down, the doors open up, we're going to be like, yeah, that was pretty cool. You know, those in-house concerts was kind of key, but how wouldn't it be cool to see that brass group like right up close?
Right.
Really cool. And I think it's going to reinvent itself. I also think that your generation and around, not my generation, because yeah, we're whatever, but your generation, it's not going to be the same as Columbia Artists and all those big agencies. I think it's going to be much more of a cooperative thing, where people are going to work together to get art concerts out there and get the audiences and promoting things. It's not going to be just a manager, you know, go out there and play the concert. I don't care where it is. You know, I'm going to own my 7%, I own my 10%. Get your sorry ass out there. I don't think it's going to be the same way. Mm-hmm. But I think there's going to be more appreciation of it because of the internet. I think it's going to come back. It might not be fast, but it's going to come back.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. And I think that whenever something like this happens and the world kind of feels like it comes to a standstill, there becomes like this kind of like artistic renaissance.
In history, that's happened every time there's been a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
For centuries. You read it and it's not only artistic, but it's social. It's on a person-to-person basis. I mean, every level is affected. And usually in a constructive way.
Yeah.
Maybe not immediate, but it definitely morphs things into another understanding and appreciation and level of workability.
I totally agree. And I mean, you can't disagree with that because you can see it happen in history.
I mean, if people, I'm always surprised at the number of people who, I don't like history. You're kidding me, right? You don't like history. You can read things in history that happen like, holy crap, I couldn't make that up. If I wrote that in a screenplay, I'd be laughed off the fucking lot.
Right.
It's incredible. If you don't know history, you might as well close your eyes and just walk down the bloody road and hope you don't get hit.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important. But I think we're going through tough times, yada, yada. We got to wake up with social issues, yes. We got a pandemic, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We have issues of leadership. Let's just leave it at that. You know, we're in a shitstorm. We really are. But I mean, I think it's going to change for a few reasons. One, things like the pandemic and the social issues, if it rock bottom and no one's going to just walk away and wait for a report, or let's do a study on it, that's not going to freaking happen anymore.
Right.
And the COVID doesn't give a rat's ass what we think.
Right.
It's going to run its course.
Yep.
And pretty much just politically, people are getting sick of the whole thing. So things are going to just change. It's a challenging time, but I think it happens sometimes. You know, we were going through times and it's been coasting along. And
yeah, well, I think one thing has fostered the other also. I mean, everybody kind of being bolstered up and lots of people being in dire straits financially, a lot of people being out of work. they have a hard time getting a hold of any sort of unemployment. They're just, they feel really, really scared and really like hopeless. And then all of a sudden this thing happens socially. And it's just like, man, I mean, talk about a powder keg, you know?
Yeah. But the thing is, everybody's in it together. And now with like the social things that was going on is, and the whole world is waking up and beginning to rattle its chains about this. So it's not just little old America like, well, you screwed that up again. It's bigger than that, you know? So that's the thing that's a good thing too, I think, about, if you could say a good thing, about these three elements, the horsemen of the apocalypse that are riding with us. They're riding over everybody, literally everybody in the world. It isn't like, well, it sucks to be you. No, we're all in together equally. You know what I mean? So it's, in that way, it's good. So everybody's paying attention. Everybody's trying to change it. Everybody's has something to win and something to lose. Everybody's got skin in the game.
Yeah, man. So with everything that's been happening right now, I mean, I know that school is kind of out and everything, but I mean, how did the end of your semester go with your students?
Good. I mean, I hadn't had that much experience, not especially extensively teaching on Zoom, but it was better. I mean, certainly not ideal. But I was able to get things across to them, keep them busy and challenged. You know what it's like when you're sitting in a room, you can really see the details of what's going on, hear different things, subtly things that you can't pick up with the Zoom. But he was doing okay. The main thing is to keep them motivated and keep them busy and progressing in a larger sort of chunk. And sometimes I couldn't get into the minutia of what was going on.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it went okay. You know, it's something we can't do forever. I know our school is hoping to start by coming back with real lessons, with some protocols put in place. So we're going to be back up in some limited classes, etc. I know some schools are not.
Right.
I mean, I hope the COVID doesn't rear its ugly head again, so we have to go it again totally. But
yeah, I hope not also. I think that with what's been going on with the students in the end of their semesters, it actually can be really telling, especially for performance majors, which kids are serious and which ones just kind of like, hey, it's an excuse to kind of get away with doing the least possible.
It's true. It does show the people who are really going to be self-motivated, whether, you know, you're feeding them or not. Most of my people, I must admit, they stepped up and they kept, you know, coming back every lesson and doing stuff. And I kept shoveling more stuff for them. And so they were coming up, you know.
That's really great. Well, you've built such an amazing program over there since you've gotten there. You're really putting out some top-notch students.
I mean, I feel like I'm working well with the talent I have. All of these people have really quite remarkable strengths. When I first came here, I couldn't say that was quite the same. And I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, most of these young people, especially, I guess, so many undergrads that are amazing, preponderance of undergrads, they're all from right around, you know, Missouri, et cetera, Iowa, et cetera. And they're incredibly talented. I don't know what's in the water, but whatever. I mean, I'm working with them and pushing them further. But I mean, I'm flabbergasted at some of the things they're able to do.
At the level of horn playing is just going up?
I do think it is. As nature does it, equipment got better, it gets better. You want to play cleaner. You hear recordings, more recordings are for a while now that's falling off. But so you're trying to emulate so that there's a cleanliness, there's a detail sort of work.
Mm-hmm.
My only concern a bit sometimes is kids, not just kids, brass players, for the sake of trying to be really accurate and pristine, they don't put the music first. They don't. There's a technical ability and prowess, and there's something to be admired. But sometimes it's artistically a Pyrrhic victory. It's like, wow, I'm not moved. But it's incredible, but I don't feel the passion. I don't feel it enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm constantly telling the students, you know, like, no one wants to hear the horn. No one cares a rat's ass about hearing the horn. What they want to hear is someone sing with the voice of the horn. Mm-hmm. So everything you do, even if it's a technical study, you've got to make it sing. So you have to come from a singing voice. I mean, I tell my students, everybody, we're in it because we have innately a spiritual, at least, and even artistic Pavarotti in the inside of our brain that is singing. We have to make sure that we're doing that first. And so I oftentimes get them to sing first. So did you listen how you emphasize a note? You notice how you tapered that note? You were thinking about it. That's the Pavarotti up there. You need to make him come out. He has to be heard first. He's our goal. You put him out on the table and you figure out how to make the horn sound like that. You know?
That's so true, man. I think that it's so important for brass players to listen to non-brass players.
Yeah.
To listen to violinists, cellists, piano players, just people who are not worried about phrasing by the necessity of breath or not worried about technically working this machine right. We're working with.
I mean, we have God knows we have a lot to worry about. And right. That's true. Well, but that's the whole point is that you want the listener to forget about that. Like players like yourselves, when you get up and play, no one's worried about, is Chris going to make it tonight? No, no one's worried about that. And musically, we want to keep stepping up that way. I mean, you know, the best people we ever heard, you know, you didn't ever think of that. No,
you never thought about it. And I think that that one kind of secret, if you can call it that, to playing with better endurance and playing like more accurately is just playing along with the karaoke track in your head. Because then you start forgetting about all of those little things that you would normally be thinking about and just start thinking about the song, the music.
Right.
And it's almost like the Music Man, where he talks about the think system, you know? I really actually kind of believe in the think system. I mean, if you can imagine it in your head, that it is more likely to come out.
We got to think about things a lot in all different ways. For instance, most of the time when we don't have great days, things are not feeling good or whatever, and we analyze the bejeebers out of it. We look at it from this end, we step over here and poke at it there, like, yep, that still sucks. You know, right. I don't know what's wrong here. You analyze it. But on the good days, we're like a dog rolling in the grass, right? Like, this feels great, awesome, you know? We're not thinking about, why is it feeling good? What is it? Characterize it, understand it, feel it, look at it. You know, so we really understand that too. So I think it's really important that we look at ourselves physically and emotionally on both ends of things in order to replicate and eradicate.
Yeah.
It's really important.
That gets me thinking about, like, you as a young player. You started out on the horn a little bit late, right? Weren't you, like, 16 or?
I was 16, and I got my first job when I was 19, so I only played about 3 years.
Right. There's not a lot of time in that three-year period to be thinking about the technical aspects of what can go wrong. You're just making music on it.
No, I was just playing. I had some natural talent. I got some direction and stuff, of course, but not much detail work. Basically, I seemed to be a naturally talented horn player, so the teacher helps him out, but you don't talk about too much. It's like, don't talk, don't look at him. He might break.
Yeah.
You know? So pretty much when I got a first job, it was like, wow, you're on your own. And then,
well, what was your first job?
Calgary Philharmonic in 1972 for 2 years. And then I went to Vancouver for another 10 years. And about 2 years into that, 2 or 3 years into that, my embouchure just gave out, just fell apart.
Huh.
Cause no one had talked about too much about what it was.
Right.
And so that was the first time I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm not going to go back to any teacher. I had a couple of teachers and I'm like, no, I'm going to figure this out. And so I started my own progress, and it's happened a few times over my career where I just fell apart and built myself back up to the point where at the end, last 15, 20 years anyway, I look like a very natural, easy player, but it was all constructed. It was all manufactured. I trained myself to be a natural player. So I ended up being my best pupil and my best teacher. You know, I did learn a lot from like Barry Tuckwell and Roland Berger. Those were fantastic, but those weren't long-term. But then at the time, with the way I was playing, you don't need much.
Right.
You put me at the time. So I approached my playing, the problems and the solutions. Like, how simple can I make this?
Mm-hmm.
How simple can I make a problem? How simple can I make a solution? If it's too complex, it's probably not really truth. If you have to do too many gimmicks or combine too many things, it's not rocket science, right?
Right, right.
It feels like, what's a symptom, what's a cause? Sometimes the symptom of what's going on, we think it's a cause.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. So we have to completely always keep breaking things down and experimenting. And for me, it was like, again, you know, experimenting, like, how easy can I make this?
Right.
Balance of resistance. And then when I oftentimes would think, I figured it out. Then I try the exact opposite. And about 80% of the time, it's like, damn it, that shouldn't have happened. So you learn again by reevaluating what you've done and not just sticking to a path, thinking like, if I missed this note, it's been 159 times, but I know the brass gods will allow me because they will see my noble effort at 160. They will grant me this note. No, they won't.
You don't deserve that note.
You don't deserve it because you're dumb as a bag of hammers. You need to figure it out and do it differently.
Going back to the chamber music and the playing with Canadian brass and Empire brass, that kind of playing is a different animal also.
Yeah.
You don't have 20 bars of rest in between each huge section that you have to play. And a lot of people are under a misconception that you have to play any softer or anything like that with a brass quintet. Also, as a horn player, I've found that to project in a purely brass setting, I mean, I have to really play also. I mean, that combined with the fact that there's no rest and that it's a fast-paced show because it's piece after piece after piece for 2 hours.
It's totally different. It changed me when I joined the Canadians, because in those days, you didn't have too many different kinds of horn schools. It was Con 8D and Con 8D. That was about it. And so I played a big Con 8D, big mouthpiece, because my teacher was a chamber student. And so I had this big, beautiful sound, and I had great endurance for an orchestral player. But once I started having to do the Canadian brass stuff, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Two things I discovered. One, I had to change the way I played. I also had to change my equipment. And I found that very quickly, because right before I actually officially joined the group, 3 months before, I had been invited to Tokyo, I can't remember the name of the school, the Akiyama taught at. He wanted me to come teach and play. And that was something was set up before I joined the Canadians, just within a few months. So I was going to join the Canadians, I was leaving the orchestra. I went to the Tohugakuin, that's what it was, Tohugakuin school. And he wanted me to play concertstück with the orchestra. Okay, fine. So 2 days before we're starting the rehearsal stuff, he comes to me and says, maybe you play first horn on the second half too. I said, well, what are we doing? And I said, he said, Heldenleben. So I did the concertstück and then I did Heldenleben, which normally wouldn't have been a big deal, and it wasn't a big deal. But at the time when I joined the Canadians, I officially joined the Canadians, so I had to be playing their gold horns, which at this time was the Shilke, because Shilke kept him up, right, with Yamaha.
Yeah.
So the initial horns that Yamaha built were modeled after the Shilke horns. So okay. I had Graham Page's gold-plated Shilke horn, which was a Geyer model horn, which felt like a toy to me compared to the Con.
Right, right.
More resistance, it was brighter. I think this sounds like absolute. But I was playing that, and I was hitting the notes. It was fine, but I thought this is going to sound like. When I got the tape of the concertstück and the Heldenleben, Heldenleben in particular sounded amazing. It was so good. But to me, it sounded so bright up close. Right. And I realized my concept of sound had to change. And so that, as you well know, it was a brass quintet. You can't be too dark and heavy.
When I first started playing brass quintet stuff, I was playing an 8D also. I played an 8D for 20 plus years. Right. And it felt like I was working so hard all the time. And I would listen back to recordings and I'm like, where am I? Like the sound was too wide.
Right. While it was a warm sound, it didn't have enough core to really compete with the directness and the intensity of a trumpet or even a trombone.
Right.
So that was a eye-opening thing to get the quality of sound. But the other thing too is I found with the groups I was in, I quickly realized, and if you listen to, especially the Empire and well, the Canadians too, the recordings, you know, recordings like, of course, like the sound is right here, soft, right. Loud, it's always just right there on the CD or recording. But if you listen to it as a brass player, you think they're actually playing quite lightly. And in the concerts, in order to survive 2 hours of night after night, like you do, and I did, the general energy, everybody had to be incredibly efficient.
Yes.
But generally speaking, what you would think of as a normal mezzo forte in an orchestra, a mezzo forte became the mezzo piano was your mezzo forte. So all the dynamics came down a notch so you could survive. And also the balance was better.
Right.
But we actually would play quite lightly 80% of the time. And then when you did put the heat on, it made a big difference. And then you wanted to play really soft. You really took the pedal off, the gas pedal off, and you really light. But the mezzo forte was what I would consider even practice playing mezzo piano.
I do want to mention that you said it wasn't, you know, normally a big deal to play the concertstück and Heldenleben on the same concert. That's a big deal, dude. Most people would be like, you want me to, huh?
I mean, as I said, as I went along, I became very, very efficient. And strong. I played a lot. I practiced a lot, but I was always reevaluating things. One of the cornerstones for me, and I know that I get pushback on this sometimes, and people are like, well, that's very nice, but I didn't do a routine every day. And that was not just warming up. I tell my students, I said, you know, if you want to just come in here and play 20 minutes and come here and hope for the best, you're really screwing yourself over. Mm-hmm. You need to do a routine. A byproduct of a routine is warming up. But you need to challenge and fix every element. Every part of your playing must be pushed out, improved, smoothed, and glossed over, varnished, pushed, tightened down, every element of it every day for two reasons. One, physically, you're going to get better. So today, you're going to be playing whatever it is. If it's Mahler 5, a Pops concert, a brass quintet concert, whatever. You're going to be working 100%.
Right.
And you know it. And psychologically, you could walk on stage saying, you know, I fucking well deserve this. I earned it. I did the work. I'm here. I'm ready to go. And whereas, you know, a lot of times when you're like, I need a chance to warm up, like, oh, I hope it works, you know.
Right. I think that it's important to have a routine, but I think that it's important to have like a routine that you can hang your hat on that isn't 2 hours long or an hour long, you know.
Yeah. My routine went from 45 minutes to an hour, but it changed depending on the playing I was doing, how my chops felt. All the key elements were always there, but I would emphasize and change them and alter them in different ways depending on what I needed.
Yeah.
But it was really important that you hit everything in whatever fashion, you know, you do. So I felt it was an important way. And for me personally, it's the way I continue to develop and get stronger and better all the way to the end. So,
yeah. For a person to have a routine, that means that they're hitting the basics every day.
Exactly.
You know what they say about the basics. I mean, it's like there are two kinds of people who play basics all the time. That's beginners and people who know what they're doing.
Exactly. You know? Exactly right. Exactly. And if you want to ride on your laurels, like, well, I don't need to warm up. What I tell those people, I said, I tell you what, you don't need to warm up. You sound great. You're doing great. Excellent. Excellent. Would you like to do better? No? Oh, that's fine. Usually they say, well, of course. I said, okay, here's a little plan here. Here's a routine. I want you to try for 5 days in a row. Just 5 days. That's all. Mm-hmm. You know, but I want you to do it 45 minutes every day prior to every other playing. And this is the kind of things that you're going to be doing, thinking about doing whatever. Just try for 5 days. See how you feel physically and psychologically at the end. If you don't feel any different and you feel like it was a waste of time, excellent. You proved me wrong. Just try it. Without fail, most people come back and say, damn it, you know, I am better and more consistent, you know, so I want to, I value what the idea of that responsible sort of work ethic can be to doing the basics. Now, the other thing is, I think it's important in the routine is some people end up with a 2-hour routine, in my mind, doing too much of the same thing and too much. They don't really challenge enough. You don't want to just go to your comfort level. You always want to go push by the comfort levels every day, just a little bit. The high notes, the low notes, the volume, the tone, the crescendos. You don't want them to be just the same. They need to be different. My ethic was always, I tell my students, you only have one job. You've got to be better than yesterday, but not as good as tomorrow.
I like that, man. I think that a thing that you just said is really important, which is push past it, but just a little bit.
Yeah, you don't want to damage, but you don't want to just stay in the comfort box. You have to keep pushing gently and differently every day. Every day is a slight variation. No day is exactly the same.
Right.
The principles are the same, but the application is not.
We have like this weird thing where it'll be like, oh, I'm feeling all about it today, so I'm just going to go gung-ho. I'm going to go beyond what I can do and blah, blah, blah. And then you become your lazy self again and you turn that off. And then you try to hit it really hard again. What works better though is improving yourself a little bit every day. And that happens with everything. That's the same way with saving money. That's the same way with losing weight. That's the same way with improving your playing. It's everything has to happen little by little, but consistently. You're not all of a sudden tomorrow going to go from here to here. You have to have this gradual rise.
Right. Younger people, I found that that they would go through plateaus. But I found the more experience you got, you're constantly going like this. The plateaus were not the breakthroughs, as it would maybe, you know. They tend to happen. But that in sometimes with the students, you got to say, like, you just had a breakthrough, but don't look for that every day, okay? We went through a rocky path to get here. So you got to just maintain that the diligence of working on it. You know, don't take it for granted. So, I mean, I feel sorry for the young students because they – even when for us, but I mean, for nowadays, and like, what are we going to do? What do I know? How can I get a job? How can I really work? Blah, blah. So they're just scared.
Well, even all the auditions have been canceled.
I know. It's like, it was hard enough before. It's like, I mean, eventually it's going to come back, but it's scary for them. I understand, you know.
When I was young, one of the things that taught me the most about myself was recording myself and even experimenting with multi-tracking. I mean, me and my buddy, when we were roommates in college, I was probably 18 or 19, and he was a few years older than me. He's a trombone player named Nathan Tanoe. He plays with Celine Dion now. He's her like chief arranger and all this stuff. But when we were in college together, he had this like 8-track recorder that could multi-track, you know? And I remember once I discovered that thing, man, I was trying to record every excerpt, like all four. Or I was trying to record Kerry Turner quartets or anything I possibly could. And the first thing I realized was my time really sucks. And the second thing I realized was my pitch really sucks because it doesn't lie. Mm-hmm. And you're having a hard time playing with yourself, you know, playing with other people. So now, right now in this time when everybody's kind of stuck at home, I see a lot of people investing in recording equipment, investing in ways to record themselves and try to be creative.
Right.
That's going to benefit a lot of younger players.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, that kind of thing just didn't really happen that much in my generation. You didn't have the technology.
Right. Yeah. You had to have a $200,000 studio to be able to do that. Yeah. Stuff. But it's really cool to see right now. And I enjoy it every time I go onto social media and I see somebody being creative and making something, you know. But it's also important to remember that if you are going to post something of yourself playing, to make sure that you've got some quality control going on.
And, it's like, well, that was, you know, just it doesn't have to be perfect, but I mean, don't put something up there that you like you're going to regret later on.
Right. They want to put out lots of stuff, and they put it out now, and all this stuff. It's much, much better if you've recorded this entire thing and you've put a lot of work into it and you listen to it and you go, then maybe you should just do it again.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly.
It's worth it because you're going to gain all that experience. It'll be faster the second time and better. It's like putting out a story. Proofread your first draft and then you have to have a second draft. And then finally you put out this great product. But if you're going to put out product, put out great product.
Right. Now, so a lot of people are doing out of boredom, which is, you know, but you still got to be careful of what you're doing because there is a lot of stuff out there now and it's going to dilute your product and everybody else's product to some degree. So, I mean, the fact that it's easy to do is good news and bad news.
I mean, you know, if like a program, like an a cappella program or something, like, there's only so much that you can do with the sound on that. So even if you are a great player and you decide that your only investment that you're going to make in your recording is an app that costs, you know, $10, it's like, yeah, you might want to rethink that because even if you're a great player, you're not going to sound great on that app. So it's worth the few $100 to like get like a real program and do it the right way. I mean, I that's my opinion on things.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm really curious to know what are some of your favorite performances that you've done? I mean, I know you've done thousands, but are there any that really stick out?
The thing is, like you said, there's been thousands of them.
Right.
In any given time, there's like, wow, that was a really good, I nailed it, you know. And a couple of them I have on tape. There was a couple smaller fives that were live performances. Like, yeah, that was pretty good. Yeah. And, you know, concertos, Strauss concertos, the live recording of me doing a Strauss second. I think it's up on YouTube. and it was almost nothing in it. And it was good. Sometimes it was not just a favorite concert. I mean, I remember many times with the quintets, it was like we were on the road, as you know, this is, I'm speaking to the choir here. You're on the road, you're playing the piece concert for the 100th time, you know, and it's like, oh, we're doing it. But something clicks, it's not even one person, it's just, it suddenly becomes like, wow, this is amazing. Mind meld.
Yes.
Of stuff. So, and those kind of things just happen and you just appreciate them. They go by. Sometimes they weren't aimed for. They just happened. And there are many times with orchestral pieces, it was not just my playing. It was just this piece just came together.
Right.
Because of the conductor, in spite of the conductor. A lot of Vancouver Symphony recordings were very good quality. So that would represent orchestrally.
Yeah.
I mean, Empire Brass, Canadian Brass, they're there, you know, and they're still classics. So
The
solo recordings, I've got a ton of those. So, I mean, really, there's just like, there's a lot of stuff. If somebody's curious, I mean, I've just gotten contacted by a young man that I'm going to talk to him tomorrow. He's like, he just studied out of Chicago and he's just fascinated with, he says, how did you get your sound? You sound so easy and so fluid. And so he just thought, he got sort of hooked on all the different stuff that's out there that I've done.
Right.
I mean, I never came from it from a brass player. I sang a lot. And so when I took up the horn, I felt that sound was there, but I never thought of it as anything but singing.
Did you play anything before the horn or sing or anything?
Yeah, I played some classical guitar, which is what I'm playing now. Mm-hmm. Since I stopped playing the horn, I went back to the guitar. Well, I went back to the guitar in about 2008 or 6. While I was still with the National Symphony, I figured by that time, I got the horn figured out. I got it down. So I got a little extra time. So I'm going to like take up the guitar again. So I was playing the guitar again. But when I moved here, trying to take, you know, full-time horn, full-time teaching, playing the guitar and a life, I just couldn't do it all. So I put the guitar down again after the five, six years I was playing it. But then in 16, when I stopped playing, she's my new mistress. I'm like, that's my guitar, you know? So
that's
I had a great time playing with it every day, exploring and doing it. Again, I'm self-taught. Uh-huh. I do a lot of stuff my own way. I find pieces and I reimagine them and figure out how to do it. Spanish, flamenco, you know, pop arrangements. I do my own stuff. So
who's a favorite guitarist of yours?
I mean, I listen to some. I don't listen to a lot of guitarists because, again, it was like with the horn. I mean, I listened after a while, but then I would stop listening. It's like, what am I going to say? What am I going to do?
Right.
And so the majority work with, even with the guitar stuff, is I'll start with the piece, but then by the time I play it and learn it and it's all memorized, then I've completely rewrote it. For me, it feels better. But at least it's a voice. It's a singing voice. And it's such an intimate thing. It's so different than the horn.
The guitar has always been kind of close to my heart because my father plays great guitar. He doesn't read music or anything like that, but he writes a lot of music, a lot of lyrics. He's got a book with like 400 songs that he's written, and I can point out any lyric to it, and then he knows the music to it. And if I let him listen to anything, I mean, he can play stuff back to me. He just can't read it. You know?
Right. That's amazing.
I often tell people, I wish I had my dad's ears. Even better musician, you know?
Wow.
But
that's neat. Well, you do have good ears, so something rubbed off.
Well, yeah, you kind of have to for our instrument, huh?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
You're one of the few musicians who has played in both Canadian Brass and Empire Brass. And I know you get asked this a lot, but I just wanted to know about the transition. I know how the transition happened. I don't know that a lot of people who are listening know how that transition happened.
Yeah. Well, what happened was I joined the Canadians, and then Chuck said, okay, we're going to spend 2 years paying Graham Page, the original horn player, out. After that, we'll make you a full member, equal partner.
So they paid him out for a year or two?
For 2 years.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was fine. So after 2 years go by, a little time goes by, and I'm saying, hey, Chuck, so we have this conversation about being an equal partner, you know. And the group, it was at lunchtime, I remember, at a restaurant we used to eat at. And he said, well, you know, we kind of rethought that a little bit. And but we're not really into that now. I said, what do you mean? Well, you know, we spent all these years making it to what it is. And so for you to, you know, cash in on that, I said, well, I'm not really interested in cashing in necessarily, but the product that I'm, you know, the new recordings and what we're doing now, I want to be a representative, an equal voice, as you said. I said, look, I have a lot of responsibilities. And am I doing a good job? Oh, no, you're sounding great. But, you know, I said, I have as much responsibility or more as the beat, as reinventing and keeping it up and keeping it fresh and pushing the envelope more.
Right.
So I'm not just coasting on your laurels. I'm improving them.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Yeah, of course. But we don't want that. I said, look, that makes me the only employee. I said, that's not fair. And that's not what you told me. Now, Chuck and I, it doesn't matter. It's fine. It's just, it was not a big deal. Well, it was a big deal. But, you know, it's fine. It's what it is. And we get along fine.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I said, well, I'm going to have to resign. And they said, well, nobody resigns from the Canadian Brass. I said, really? So I did. Well, in the last few months that we were touring before I actually exited the group, we did a number of concerts. So one of the places we played was Severance Hall in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, I didn't really know really much about the Empire Brass at all, or hardly that they existed. I didn't know. I wasn't paying attention. So everybody in the group of the Empire Brass, except Rolf, was in the audience. And they hated the Canadians, right? They just hated the Canadians.
Hmm.
And the Canadians didn't care, you know.
Right.
There was this... Rolf in particular and all those, you know, they didn't play with a big sound and they would dance around in wigs, etc. So anyway, they came to the concert and come to find out later on, like they came back and Rolf said, well, how was it? And they said, well, the, you know, typical, but their new horn player is actually pretty good. He sounded pretty good. Oh, cool. Well, anyway, during this month, number of months, like 3 or 4 or 5 months, 4 months or so, Chuck was phoning every horn player he knew in the world saying, we have an opening. We want to audition. Who should we call? You know some names. So he was calling all these people. And one of the persons he called was Dave O'Hanion. And Dave said, well, yeah, sure. I mean, I know so-and-so and you could call so-and-so and so-and-so. And then Dave said, what about me? And Chuck said, what? Are you interested? He says, yeah, maybe. So they got together, played secretly, all very secret, right? Mm-hmm. And of course offered him the job. And that wasn't immediately known at the time. And then they were middle of a tour somewhere here in the Midwest, from what I understand, I was told. And they were on the tour bus. Uh-huh. And Dave said, hey, well, we need to have a chat because I'm leaving the group. I joined the Canadians. And Rolf just went ballistic, completely okay. Ballistic, literally pulled the side of the road in the middle of nowhere, threw Dave and his horn and suitcase off on the side of the road. Get out. And so they were scuffling for, you know, sub horns, et cetera, for a few weeks and whatever. I don't know. Oh, so they had a sub. And so they were like, what are we going to do? And then one of the guys said, you know, why don't you call that horn player Canadian Brass? He sounded pretty good.
Right.
So I got this phone call from Rolf saying, hey, you're interested in maybe playing with us? And I said, yeah, I'll give it a try. And so I went down to Boston from Toronto and played with them. And that obviously worked out. Not without an understanding with Rolf, which was a piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
But he, we ended up getting along just fine. I was the only person he left alone in that group. He was the most cruel person.
I've heard stories, man.
Yeah, it was horrible. But he left me. Well, what happened is I came down there and in the rehearsals, first rehearsal in a few hours, and he was the meanest son of a bitch to all these people. I mean, Jesus, man, why are you being so, what? And he wasn't saying anything. And then he started coming after me. And I said, Rolf, we're going to have a little conversation here. You asked me to be here. I don't need to be here. I said, I'm here to help you out and see if this fits. But I'm not going to be treated that way. And what I'm going to do right now is do it my way or I'm out of here. Okay. Oh, and a typical bully, like, oh, of course, because he didn't know how far he could push me. And I always delivered. And he actually liked my playing quite a bit. And so he never, ever, ever said shit to me. It was like I wasn't even in the room. He would say the most nasty-ass things to everyone else, but he never went after me.
Wow.
That didn't mean that I liked him, but.
Well, Sam Palafin used to say that he was like, he felt like the peacemaker of the group all the time. He was always putting out.
Oh, he was always trying to put it together. Always trying. And yet, Rolf was the most, he was so mean to Sam. He was ridiculous. And Sam was just like, he would just take it. It was like, it was ridiculous. And just the hurtful things and the things he said all the time and did.
When Sam would talk about it, I had this vision of Rolf walking around with shoes that are made out of matches, and Sam is like behind him with water, just putting out all these fires.
And that's what he did. At the same time, he was throwing matches on Sam.
Yeah.
You know, it was really a surreal thing. I mean, it was very difficult. I mean, when we were on stage making music, Jesus, nothing could touch it. Nothing could touch it. When we were not making music, it was painful. Yeah. Most of the time. We had our affiliations and relationships, and everybody got along pretty much without Rolf.
Right.
But he was very awkward.
What was the main difference that you found going from one group to the other?
Definitely the Canadians were, they obviously had a different take on the concert and the show aspect of it, which was very valuable.
Right.
The facility. They were a lighter sort of playing group overall, although the Empire was... It was still played light, but it could turn on the heat and bring the stuff together in a different way. Yeah. I still feel, and I still, when I coach brass quintets, I always recommend that seating with the Empire. I don't know why more people don't do that. It was the perfect seating for brass quintet, but it wasn't seating, right? You know what the seating I'm talking about?
Yeah, you want to tell the people.
Well, the idea most of the time the brass quintets, as everybody knows, is a little horseshoe. Everybody's staring at one another, blowing into each other's bells. Right. And then the tuba players in the back looking out over the stand. Mm-hmm. Well, acoustically and physically, that's just not ideal. What we used to do, and as you well know, is Sam would sit. If you're looking at the stage, Sam was on stage right, sitting on a piano stool, a piano bench. His bell was tilted out. So he was very easily very clear.
Right.
Then the other three were in a line, trombone, Rolf, second trumpet, all facing straight out. If they wanted to play soft, you put your bell down into the stand a little bit. If you wanted to go up, you just raise the belts a bit and you let it go. But everything was equal.
Yes.
And I was on the end, so I could open my bell to the audience and graduate it back and forth, depending if I needed to be softer or louder. Mm-hmm. But when everybody, if you really wanted to turn up the heat, you could bring five bells straight out.
Yep.
Acoustically, you had much more color and control. You could hear each other because you're standing and you're closer together. You don't need to blow into each other's bells, and you don't need to do many cutoffs. As you well know, when you're standing close, you can tell what someone's doing instinctually almost.
Yes, yeah.
But when you really wanted to bring on the heat, you could just do it. You could level the ground.
That's how Boston Brass sets up.
Right, right.
I love it. As a horn player, I love it because if I want something to sound broad and like omnipresent, I can turn my bell angle a little bit and have it sound like that. Or right. If we're playing jazz, or if we're playing something that's, you got to bring the heat, you got to be like a laser beam.
Right, then you can do that.
Be a bell front instrument, you know,
right.
Standing that way. Right. And I especially love it because it gives you a unique perspective on the group. I'm almost always staring at everybody. I can see that.
As a horn player, you are told. You were in front of their bell, so you could tell how are they articulating, how they left off the note, when they're going to attack, without even thinking about it. You sensed it. You were right there.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, I don't understand why more brass quintets don't do that. I mean,
I hate the horseshoe also. It's like you're closing off most of the audience. You know, it's like you're shaped like this, and the audience out spread in that. And you're
one thing I always do with it, whenever I'm teaching student groups, one of the first things I do after a while, and if they're in this sort of mode of that thing, I always make sure I take the whole group apart and put people as far away as I can in the room so no one can see anyone. And somebody's in this corner facing that direction, someone's over here, someone's in the back over there. So you're really far apart and you can't see each other.
Right.
Now I said, now you're going to not count yourself in, but you know, I'm going to count and then just start, and then you're going to play. And then you're going to do it by yourselves, just by listening to a breath. One person's going to breathe, and you're going to come in. Without fail, it's perfect attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're listening. They're really listening. Instead of waiting for this or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the quintets, as you well know, I mean, when you sit down in an orchestra now, you're a totally different person. You're much more sensitive. You're listening. You have your ears out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to all sorts of colors and instruments that oftentimes orchestral players, you're like, well, what's my first horn doing or what's the trumpet doing? You know, you're not really listening to the entire picture enough. Not always, but many players don't. Whereas when you're doing that brass chamber music, it's like the fine detail work is going off on a hair trigger all the time.
Yeah. And you're also used to being kind of naked. I mean, it's when it's only five people on the stage, it's just, I mean, it's a whole different world than sitting in an entire orchestra.
Yeah. And there's a beauty in sitting in that kind of huge music making machine.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Especially as principal horn. But there is definitely you're just sometimes you're a cog in the wheel, and that's fine. That's the way it is. But like you say, in the quintet, there's a spotlight on you all the time.
Right.
Both are valuable. Both are interesting. You have to be a team player on both. You have to be a different kind of team player as an orchestral player. You have to be a different kind of team player as an orchestral player if you're in the section or a principal. So it's all valuable.
Well, that's why I think it's cool that you in particular, you've worn so many hats at the highest level. You know, I mean, a lot of people go through a career as a chamber musician. A lot of people go through a career as a soloist, and some go through a career in an orchestra. But there aren't a whole lot of people who have done everything at the top level like you have.
Yeah, it's funny because Jens Linderman, a great friend, one of my best friends, he would always introduce me to All-Star Brass, like, nobody's done as much as Monty Hayes. Nobody's, and I would be embarrassed, like, oh, Jens, shut up, you know. And actually, one day I got to thinking, like, you know, you're actually right. I don't know if anyone, and I never set out to do it. I just kept wanting to challenge myself and you know, just be open to whatever is going on. And so I just ended up doing a lot of stuff. And so, but I actually think, you know, I mean, there are some obviously many, many fabulous players.
Right.
Have been and are and will be. But the actual amount of stuff, and like you say, at a high level, I can't think of that many. And then the weird thing is I started putting together last year, being in Canada for 20 years and then even in the States to some degree, especially with the CBC, they taped, you had a lot of tapes. We had a lot of chamber concerts, a lot of stuff.
Right.
Aside from the 50 CDs, but I spent a fair piece of change digitalizing all these tapes. It actually comes out to a full week of music 24/7.
Man. And that's just the stuff that's been recorded.
No, this is not recorded. This is just other live concerts, other chamber concerts, other stuff that I've done aside from the CDs.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So I'm going to get that organized and get it up because, yeah, it's ridiculous. A lot of it was recording live orchestral concerts off the CBC radio and chamber music concerts that I did put together for them. I ran a chamber music series for them for a number of years.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff that's not available.
This is what I think is great about YouTube now. I mean, I see YouTube as kind of the library, you know? And it's like Facebook and Instagram and stuff. That's where you go to like kind of discover something new. And it's like, wow, this is cool. This just showed up on my feed. But like a place like YouTube is a place where literally anything you want to know or hear, it's like going to the library now.
Yeah, it's true. It is the new library in many ways.
Yeah. And so I can't wait for a day where it's like somebody can like type in Marty Hackelman and just a wealth of
I need to get this up because I have it all and I have begun organizing, but it's a hot mess sometimes because some of it's not clear. The other thing that's sort of frustrating is a lot of times I got to figure out a way because a lot of it is because it went from cassette to MP3 or whatever it is. I paid this guy to do it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't do it. And he did a great job. Everything, a lot of it is off by a half step.
Oh.
It's a half step sharp, and all the tempos are faster. I listened to some chamber pieces, and I think, Jesus, I was blisteringly fast. And then I realized, and then I went back and tested the note. So the tape speeds mess things up a little bit. So there must be a program where you can put this in and get it to.
Yeah, it's definitely out there. That's actually not that
difficult. I don't think it's hard. It's just going to be time consuming to sit there and do this with all this stuff. But, you know, I've got the time. I need to get back on the wagon and get it, because I've got all these hours to organize. And I've started, you know, but I'm.
Well, it is a big project, but it's worth it, man.
I think it will be, because I don't think too many people have done that much. So it would be interesting.
This is the kind of stuff that will live on for generations. And
that's true. And that's the thing about recordings. And, you know, you and I like take it for granted, like, well, but your Boston Brass recordings, I mean, that's going to be new to somebody tomorrow. Some person's going to like, wow, that's amazing. First time. And it's like, it's been out there for years, but it's always going to be a first time for somebody.
Right.
So it's important that we get the stuff out there and we show that legacy. I think it's important.
What were your features? Like, did you have a horn feature in Canadian?
Yeah, I had a number of them. Pete Needs the Beat was a Tchaikovsky thing that was written for me. Beale Street Blues was another one.
Yes. I used to listen to Beale Street Blues, and I couldn't afford sheet music. Canadian Brass had put out the sheet music.
Right, right.
I couldn't afford it, but I had the recording, and I learned the horn part, and then I was like, I want to learn the trombone part too, and I would try to play them both. Indeed. But I mean, this is the kind of stuff that students do. Now I'm doing my thing, and I'm sure that there are students listening to recordings of mine and recordings of yours, yep. And they're doing the same thing, learning it by ear. And those are the kids who are going to be...
They'll be the next generation. Another piece written for me is, which I think Jeff had done some after I left the group, was a Paganini Variations. I forget who the guy who did the recording or did the arrangement, but... it was really kind of fun, technical stuff.
The one that Jeff did, is that the one that you did?
The Paganini.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. I had heard him do it, but I didn't know it was written for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool, man.
And the Empire, we had different kind of features. I mean, I did a bunch of Fritz Kreisler violin things that I arranged for the quintet.
I remember hearing you play the Enfoiré with them.
The Enfoiré I did, yeah. Yeah, that was funny because Rolf, we were in the middle of rehearsing in the summertime up in Tanglewood, and Rolf said, hey, he called me up one night and said, Marty, let's get a better feature for you. You need another feature. He said, can you come in with something tomorrow? And he said, tomorrow? And so I literally, I went in and got the Enfoiré and just scribbled out on manuscript paper the parts.
Oh, my gosh.
Gave it to them, and that's what's on the recording.
I don't know how you got, you know what? When I was on the road with Sam, he used to do these arrangements and stuff. And he'd be like, he's so used to just writing stuff out on manuscript.
Right.
So, you know, I need my computer. I mean, I'm a total loser when it comes to that. I mean,
Sam was brilliant with that.
Me and the guys, we will do some arranging on the road and we'll have it out tomorrow or whatever it is. But we've got the advantage of a laptop and you can hear it back and, oh, that's a mistake. I'm going to do this. And the parts look all pretty and stuff. I can't imagine sitting in a hotel room just.
We didn't do that. We just sat in hotel rooms. I mean, most of Class Brass, which is still a benchmark, those were done. Literally, we would sit around with a list of orchestral pieces and argue about what should we do. So let's do Polovici and Dan. Let's do this Prokofiev piece. And so, okay, we all agree. And then we would go get from Kalmus all the orchestral parts and the score, whatever, or all of that.
Right.
And we would just sit and listen to it and say, like, okay, the clarinet's got the melody here. Trumpet, I'll take it. Marty, why don't you take the next little viola solo? And let's try that. And we would literally pass out the orchestral parts and bracket things off, like, I'm going to play this. And then we'd go home and write out the parts based on what we did.
Right, that's not what we do, that's for sure.
That's how those arrangements came about, for the most part. All of them on that brass recording.
That's so amazing. That was, I think, the first Empire recording I ever heard. And before that, I had listened to Brass Quintet. I had a lot of brass albums. And then when I heard Empire Brass play for the first time, even in high school, I was just like, for me... And this isn't like putting down anything that had happened that you did in Canadian or anything. But when I heard Empire, I was just like, holy shit, man. The sound was so different. Everything was, it was like next level. Man, I can't thank you enough for all the stuff that you've done. I mean, I definitely would not be the player that I am now without having heard you.
Oh, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I pushed myself. I was always working hard and, I mean, I was lucky, but at the same time, it's like, I think it was Thomas Jefferson said, it's funny, the harder I work, the more luck I seem to have. I don't know how that works, but So I just was always pushing myself, because when I started, I always felt I was behind the eight ball and didn't know anything. I didn't know everything. So I was always, no one told me what to do or what not to do. So I was always 110%. So
right.
I just ended up doing stuff with no plan. You know, just work hard. Just make it good.
Make it good. I like that, man. So another road question. Did you have any experiences that you remembered that trumped everything? I mean, not playing wise, just, I mean, I know you talked about your Russia tour and how crazy stuff like that.
Here's a good example that's pretty bizarre. We did a run out from the Berkshires in the summertime on our first original old camper bus. We didn't sleep on it that much. We always stayed in hotels, but we had to travel on it. So we had a driver, Parker, and we drove to New York for a run-out gig, back to the Berkshires, got in about 2 o'clock in the morning. And there was, had been for a couple of weeks, a slight smell of gas on the vehicle, but we didn't, I don't know, some leak, who knows. So he's driving back from New York. We're all asleep on the van. And he drops everybody off. He goes to get gas. He's driving back to Rolf's Ranch to park the vehicle. And suddenly he smells smoke. He turns around. He sees a flame, pulls over the Mass Turnpike, jumps out and runs about 100 feet. Two tanks of gas blow up. At the time, it caused the biggest forest fire on the Mass Pike history.
Oh, he was right there?
Oh, yeah, it just burned up. I mean, it's two gas tanks just went bang, you know? Now, if that would have happened when we were asleep on the bus, that would have been it, you know?
Yeah.
But fortunately, it didn't. So it literally burned everything. It melted the entire van down to a molten puddle, except the back ladder was sticking out of it like this. And there's only one thing that was blew out of and survived the fire. And we don't know how or why. And it was one Playboy magazine. And Parker was there when the guys were cleaning up. One of the cleanup crew says, "Hey, look at this. This is, yeah." He says, "You want to take it?" And we said, "Parker, you idiot. Why did you give him that Playboy? First of all, it's really cool that it exists, but do you realize how much publicity we got gotten from Playboy out of this?" So, yeah. So who knows how that magazine survived, but it did. The other thing is, like, on the road, I remember, like, in Russia, there was one instance. First, when I got there, like, the second night on the tour, we went to the U.S. ambassador in Moscow, Leningrad, for a party, big do at the embassy. And so I was trying to change my flight after this tour. I needed to go someplace else, and I couldn't do it because, I don't know, it was being horsey. It was at Aeroflot, and they couldn't do anything. And all day I was trying to change my flight. And I mentioned it to the ambassador. He says, "Oh, well, you know, you're not going to get anybody that way." He says, "You know, all the rooms are booked." And of course, I says, "Well, okay. All right, if you say so." Well, they are. Because after you come home and then you come back to the hotel room and someone's wife will do your stuff.
Right.
At any rate, so he said, "What you need to do is go back to the hotel room and just start talking out loud, like these stupid Russians. In America, I can change my flight so easily, but no, not in Russia. They're so dumb and slow." Just things like this. Literally, I said, "You're kidding me." He said, "No, they're listening to everything you say." He said, "Then give it about an hour and then phone Aeroflot and you'll get your flight changed."
Uh-huh.
And that worked.
It worked?
I did it exactly as he said. I phoned up. They said, "No problem. We'll change your flight."
What?
Yeah, I know.
So did you ever have any close calls, like missing any like flights?
Oh, yeah, all the time. No, those kind of things really are terrible. Missed a flight, or you just, like you say, overslept, or like, there's always something that was going on. Just another funny story from the Russian tour. In Russia, majority, I'd say, 75% of the time, there was never any hot water in the hotels or any place.
Oh, man.
And we were in Riga, which is a resort lake place somewhere in Russia. And we stayed in this hotel that was at probably the turn of the century, incredible. But in the mid-80s, it wasn't so great. But it was best hotel in town. So we're there, and you go up to the room, and it's one of these, 12-foot ceilings, gigantic room. Each of us had a suite. I go in and want to take a bath. You know, I turn the water on in the sink in the bath, and it comes out brown. I mean, brown and ice cold, ice cold. And I let it run for like 10 minutes, nothing, you know. And so I went down to the front desk. This is like end of September. It's not terribly cold, but in September. Mm-hmm. I woke up to the desk. There's this clerk writing something. I said, excuse me, sir. I wonder if you could tell me. And he doesn't look up. He doesn't stop writing. I said, excuse me, sir. I wonder if you could tell me when the hot water will be on. November. He never looked up or stopped. He just said November. Yeah, he didn't look up. Anyway, so, oh, here's a good tour story from the Empire. I'll tell part of it anyway. So we go to Florida. We're going to go down, and you know, you live in cold places. You get a tour in Florida or something in the middle of winter. You go early, they chill out, hang, right? You want to get some warm. Yeah. So we were going down a day or two early to Florida. We'll do a little Florida tour in the middle of winter from Boston. So we're going down there, and we hit the beach. Wolf is picking up girls. Sam and Jeff and I are hanging on the beach, just chilling. And Scott decided he was going to learn how to surf with a surfboard and a sailboarding. Which I always thought looked pretty damn hard, and I never tried it. And I'm glad I didn't. Anyway, but he's going to just teach himself how to do it on the ocean. Like, really? So he's out there falling down constantly for like 2 hours. And we're like, poor bastards. And we're having drinks. And so we didn't think it's time to go in. And we didn't see Scott anymore. So we just gave up. You know. Well, the next day, come to find out, Scott did figure out how to get up on the board. But he didn't figure out how to turn.
Oh, no.
He was heading straight to Cuba. And he was miles and miles out in a fishing boat. Picked him up and called the Coast Guard.
Oh,
and the Coast Guard brought him back. Yeah, so.
That is awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
It's a great talking with you, Chris.
All right, man. Well, give my best to Kelly, and I'm sure she's inside somewhere. Oh, hey.
Duncan. The dogs. I don't know what they're barking at. Stay in touch, okay?
All right, I will, man. Catch you later, Marty.
Take care. Bye.